Lynn, and welcome along to Claribel in Conversation with me, Claire Ford, on RNIB Connect Radio. Today on the podcast, I am speaking to the Scottish sports journalist and broadcaster, David Tanner. David is a very familiar face on television after spending almost two decades with Sky Sports as their anchor of live Scottish, international and Champions League football games. Currently, David can be heard on television and radio presenting In Conversation with David Tanner, a football chat show for BT Sport, in which David can be seen interviewing and mingling with the biggest names in the world of football, the Scottish football show for Top Sport, and as guest stand-in presenter of the hilarious Football Daft podcast, which David has just finished his stint presenting. However, David will always be remembered as the presenter for the hilarious Scottish Cup draw with Sir Rod Stewart back in January 2017, which already in its three-year history has already become part of Scottish football folklore and has been streamed a countless amount of times on YouTube and other social media platforms. But did you know David's connection with us blind and partially sighted football supporters? Hello, David, and welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Claire, I'm very well, thank you very much indeed. And it's lovely to be locked down with you here.
Circumstances aren't great, but I hope we can put a smile on everybody's face with the current situation, and I hope everybody enjoys the podcast. As I said in my introduction, you've interviewed some of the biggest names from the world of football. Pele, Maradona, Johan Cruyff, Michel Platini, Kaká, Luis Figo, Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi, many, many more. But do you ever get nervous when interviewing such giants from the beautiful game?
I did when I was younger. But I think the older you get and the more practiced you become at it, Claire, the more confident you get and the better prepared you are for an interview, the better. I remember my very first interview when I was 16. I was still at school and I applied to go on a radio training course that they were running for unemployed young people. And I'd phoned up Clyde Action after hearing Dougie Donnelly on his Radio Clyde morning programme. Showing my age now. Dougie promoted this Clyde Action CSV training course. And I phoned up and said, look, I'm not an unemployed youngster, but I'm not working because I had a paper round actually. But I'm not working because I'm still at school. I'd like to take part. I'm really ambitious about working in radio and so on. And they invited me in. And after a couple of two or three, 4 weeks of doing it, the guy who was running it, a guy called Dougie Jackson, who was later well known as a DJ on Radio Clyde and Scott FM. Dougie said to me, he phoned me at home one day and said, I'm at Radio Clyde. They need a new T-boy. You're hired. And that was me, 15 quid a shift. So I had a good foot in the door there. But my first interview was when I was doing the radio training course alongside my Saturday work. And Dougie came in and he'd had lunch. And I don't know if he'd eaten anything at lunchtime. You know what I'm saying? He came in and said, I've just been in the pub and there's an old footballer there who says he'll do an interview with you. So it'd be great practice doing an interview. I said, great. I said, who is it? And he said, oh, I don't know. He said, I know nothing about football. But he said, I do know it's a famous footballer. And I thought, all right. So we had to go down to this pub, and I'm not sure if it's still there anymore in Argyle Street. This would be 1988. And I had to put my school blazer on with the vice captain's badge, may I say. It gets shoved in an Agnew's bag, as did my school tie. And we walked in with this old radio recorder that Dougie had got. And the pub was, I can always remember walking at the pub and the smoke. Cigarette smoke was so thick you could hardly see. But as we walked through the pub, this old hoof, the smoke cleared, and there behind a pint of lager and a whiskey was the great Jim Baxter, possibly Rangers' greatest ever player, and the man who famously played Keepy Uppy at Wembley when we beat England in 67. And there he was. And I sat down and I interviewed him. Of course, there was no internet then. I didn't have my football encyclopedias with me. So I had to use my knowledge and just go for it. And that's what I did. So that, you know, I started at the, you know, pretty high up, and everything after that was quite relaxed. But my first live one was doing Walter Smith at the Marriott, the Moathouse Hotel, which is now the, it's the one at the Clydeside, and Rangers had just won the league, but they weren't playing. I think it was either Aberdeen or Celtic had lost on the Saturday, and I was sent out. Everyone was at the games, so there was only me left, and I was sent out with a radio car, because I knew how to work the radio car, to interview Walter Smith and say, congratulations, you've just won the league. You know, standing at the hotel reception. That was my first live one. And, you know, you never knew when a Walter death stare was coming. So I was nervous back then doing those. But after a while, to answer your question, you don't really get nervous. And, you know, you get used to meeting these people. I'll tell you what, though, I met Dennis Law about 5 years ago, and it wasn't the first time I met him. I went down to his golf club in Manchester next to the airport, Wilmslow, I think it is. And we were waiting to interview him about a big Scotland game, the Czech Republic. And the lawman walked in, and I remember going, oh! It caught my breath, because it was just, I don't know what it was. It wasn't the first time I met him, but it was just when he walked in, I thought, wow, it's the lawman. So there you go. It just showed you, it's, as I say, not nervous now. Experience and preparation gets rid of nerves. But sometimes you meet someone and you go, wow. And the lawman was certainly somebody like that.
And you mentioned the Jim Baxter interview. What were you planning on doing with that interview once you had secured it?
Well, it was recorded on an audio cassette back then, a Marantz recorder. I remember that. We took it back to where the radio training course was happening. It wasn't at Radio Clyde. It was at Hospital Radio Glasgow, HBS. Which was in a close, a tenement close in Argyll Street, opposite the old Anderson bus station and what every woman wants shops and sort of that kind of neck of the woods. And we dubbed it onto reel-to-reel tape, and then we edited it. I remember that. And editing, even right up to when I left radio in 1995, we edited on reel-to-reel tape. And to make the edits, you had to use, it wasn't a digital program. It was, you know, scissors, little crayons for marking where the audio was, and razor blades, open razor blades. And I've still got scars on my fingers and thumbs from that day. So we would have done that. But of course, no social media back then, so we couldn't broadcast it anywhere. But I've still got the tape somewhere. Quite where, I'm not sure. My dad might have it. But yeah, still have the tape. It's actually a good interview. It's the sort of interview that's quite popular now. Tell me about your career type interviews, you know. So.
And out of all the names that I mentioned earlier on, and all the names I haven't, was there anyone who stood out as football royalty, and you sensed that you were in the presence of a true legend of the game?
Without a doubt, football royalty number one for me is Johan Cruyff. With respect to King Kenny, I met recently again, who was my hero growing up. With respect to Graeme Souness, I worked with earlier this month, who was also my childhood hero. They were terrific in that Liverpool and Scotland, those Liverpool and Scotland teams. Number one for me is Johan Cruyff. And the reason for that, Claire, is that he's the architect of modern football. He, as a player, he played the game the right way. In the 70s, he was part of that great Dutch revolution. The Dutch, first of all, got the big breakthrough in 1970 when Feyenoord beat Celtic in the European Cup final, which was a big shock at the time in Milan. And then the next 3 years, Ajax won it with Cruyff as the reason that they won it. Now, Cruyff was the first full-time professional footballer in Holland. Isn't that incredible? So they went from that in a very short space of time to having two teams winning the European Cup and 4 years in a row. And from there, he went to Barcelona and he transformed Barcelona when he played for them. Before that, Real Madrid had had them by the throat for a long, long time, backed by the fascist dictatorship of Franco. Franco died when Cruyff was there. And from there, he becomes a manager. And on his first day at the club, he told me, he said to the coaches, who's the best player at the club, in your opinion? And he said, well, it's actually a kid who plays for under-17s. And I said, well, why is this guy not in the first team if he's the best player? Oh, well, he's young, you know. And I said, what's his name? He said, it's Pep Guardiola. He said, right, promote him to the first team. And after that, Guardiola becomes a bit of a pet project for Cruyff. He's a very young player when they won the European Cup in 1992. Now, Barcelona hadn't won the European Cup until that night at Wembley. And Pep's in the team. Cruyff is the manager, chain smoking on the bench. And and they play the game the right way. And after that, he creates this tiki-taka form of football that we've seen for the past few years at Barcelona and at Manchester City. And it's beautiful football. Yeah. It's not always, doesn't always win, but it's beautiful stuff. And that stylish form of play makes him number one for me. And by the way, he hated, and this of course was box office, interviewing him for Sky, Cruyff hated Mourinho because of his negative tactics. So from that point of view, he's the architect of the beautiful game. Barcelona's new stadium will be named in his honour. And he spoke so well about football. And I'll give you one last quote from Cruyff. This is why I really like him. He said about Mourinho, what's the point of setting out not to entertain? Because if you don't lose, if you don't win, then you've not been entertained and you've not won. So what is the point? And for me, that did sum up Mourinho's time at Manchester United, possibly now at Tottenham. And it's why Cruyff was the most engaging, opinionated and, you know, terrific source of my career, certainly.
Absolutely. And to flip it to another side, was there anybody who you looked up to, say, when you were younger or during your career, who you met and you were disappointed in?
Yes, yeah. there's one very famous Scottish player who would have fitted into that category of never meet your heroes, you'll only be disappointed. Funnily enough, I did an interview with an Irish fella recently who was asking me about Billy Connolly, who was his favourite Scotsman. And I said, yeah, I've actually met him. I did a Scottish Cup draw with Billy and met him a few times at the football over the years. And I saw an interview recently with Paddy Keelty. And Patrick Keelty, the comedian, was talking about how they say that you should never meet your heroes. And Billy Connolly was an exception to that. And that was exactly the phrase that I used about the beginning, because he was just fabulous, you know. You know what, fabulous. But the biggest disappointment was, again, in Argyle Street in Glasgow, actually, where I'd done the Jim Baxter interview, where I'd been so well looked after by Slim Jim. Argentina were coming to play Scotland, and Diego Maradona was the manager, and it was his first game in charge. So the world's media rolled into Scotland. And the game was live on the TV channel I worked for at the time, Sky, and we were told, you will get an interview because you guys are facilitating the game for the world. Be at the Radisson Hotel next to the Hulman's Umbrella for 1 o'clock. So we get there at 12 o'clock, set up nice and early, all good to go. And Maradona appeared and for lunch. 2 hours later, 3 o'clock, comes out for lunch, is approached by the media guy who is flicked off. Bizarre, there's a bizarre scene where the then First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, came in and wanted his photograph taken with him, presumably because of his exploits against England. And he rolled out in his ministerial Volvo, and then Maradona disappeared. And eventually he came down for this 1 o'clock interview at 7 o'clock. And by this point, we all get a bit stressed and, oh, this isn't happening, this isn't happening. And we'd flown in a guy called Juan Cobian, who'd played for Aberdeen, had perfect English, good guy. And he'd also played with Maradona, late in Maradona's career at Boca Juniors. So I thought, oh, we're in here. And Maradona appears, sat down, microphone on, does the first interview with Argentinian TV, the rights holder, finishes that, shake hands with the guy, goes into the next seat, puts the microphone on, does the interview with the next Argentinian channel, gets up, shake hands with Juan Cobian and says, oh yeah, I remember you. Yeah, 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 yeah. And he said, this is David. And he went, hi, how you doing? Or he nodded at me. He said, how you doing in Spanish? ¿Qué pasa, wee man? And he said, so just if you sit down there, we'll do the interview. And Maradona said two words after that. The second word was off, lit a cigar and disappeared. And to this day, I've not had that interview with Maradona. So he's a big disappointment for me. And by the way, that kind of behaviour, not unusual. And I think that's why I think Maradona is a better player than Pele. But Pele is got a presidential air about him. He's a charming old fella.
Oh, yeah.
That's why he remains number one. And Maradona's never eclipsed him because of that kind of behaviour.
And in the case of disappointment in that, have you ever had what I call a Meg Ryan moment where an interviewee has been uncooperative and difficult to handle?
Yeah, Kendall Gleish was difficult when he was Celtic manager. I remember his first one of his first press conferences at Celtic was at a pub in Glasgow called Baird's Bar, which was rough and ready, to say the least, on the Gallagate. And I think it's closed down now. And the idea, I mean, it was a stupid idea. Whoever thought of it should be ashamed of themselves, but they thought they would put it in a pub. And it was so, what they said was, it was so that they could, the fans could hear directly what was being said to the press. Now, there were four or five old drunks in there. Four or five old drunks in the press corps as well. But there were, I mean, it was nonsense. It was just designed to mess us about and intimidate us. I mean, it was boorish media relations. And that particular day, I remember asking Kenny, I said, look, if you don't win this Old Firm game at Ibrox on Saturday, would you agree on Saturday, you, like everybody in here today, will be drinking in Last Chance Saloon? And before Kenny could answer, the guy behind me leaning at the bar leaned forward and said something unpleasant to me, and I just kind of walked to the other side of the room. So by the time Kenny started my answer, he was looking over at the west of the city, and by the time he'd finished it, he was looking over to the east of the city because I'd moved so far. So that was a bit weird. So it wasn't quite a Meg Ryan moment, but that was certainly that the whole concept of that was I mean, Celtic were dysfunctional at that time. They're not the slick operation they are now. So that was really, really stupid behaviour. Whoever advised Kenny on that should be ashamed of themselves. And it backfired spectacularly. And I had a famous one with Craig Levein, who bizarrely had been appointed Scotland manager and had gone to Prague on a Friday night and not played a striker. His formation was 4-6-0. And we'd lost the game against a Czech team that had lost its last game to Lithuania. So they were there for the taking. And in fact, I remember interviewing Cruyff the next morning in St. Andrews. I flew back on a 4 o'clock flight and interviewed Cruyff the next afternoon. And Cruyff was really, really, he didn't pull his punches about the 4-6-0 formation. And on the Tuesday night, Scotland played Spain. And he played two strikers. I think it was Naismith and Kenny Miller. And we did really well. In fact, we scored twice against Spain. This was a really good Spain team, world champions at the time. And then we'd lost a very late goal to Llorente, who had a spell in England. And Llorente was like a big Scottish striker, like a heat on a stick. And after the game, Craig Levine came out and I said to him, you know, looking back on Friday night, no strikers, do you regret that now, given how well? And he interrupted me and said, I'm not here to talk about Friday night. I said, I know. I'm not sure if I did say that. But anyway, he said, I'm only here talking about tonight. I said, well, how well do you think the team played tonight with strikers in it? And he looked at me as he was going to burst into tears and he just stormed off. Mm-hmm. And that was the most bizarre. It was a guy who was out of his depth, mm-hmm. a guy who'd made a mess of it, mm-hmm. was too proud to say, and ultimately was out of his depth. You know, a decent level club manager in the past, certainly, but not an international manager. And I think he got frustrated that he couldn't control people the way that he had done at club level as well. He was dealing with a different level of staff and player and, you know, even the media with the national team. So that was a strange one. And that went on a long time. I've hardly spoken to Craig Levine since then, actually. He was he made some interesting comments about that in a press conference not long after that. And after that, I didn't really speak to him very much. I thought, what's the point? But that was an interesting one. And we've been very friendly up until that point, so it was disappointing.
And as I mentioned earlier on, you started your career very, very young, at the age of 16. And when you were doing the Jim Baxter interview, you later were sending reports to STV and then to Sky Sports. But was a career in journalism or broadcasting always the career path you wanted to pursue?
Yes, it was, Claire. I'd been interested in commentary for as long as I can remember. And I'd never actually had any ambition to work in TV because our family, you know, with two blind grandparents, radio was a big, big thing in our house, as was sport. Granny and Granda didn't have a TV. They did have a radio receiver that could pick up TV signals. But by and large, the radio was on all the time, or they were listening to cassettes and of music, of comedy and all the rest of it. But we had a great appreciation for radio, perhaps more than anybody in our age group. My sister to this day still listens to The Archers, which is Granny and Granny's appointment every night. Not for me. I'm not into soaps, TV or radio. But the sports reporters, you know, it was no Radio 5 back then, it was Radio 2. The guys on Radio 2 back then were kind of big in our house and big in our family. And I listened to all sorts of weird stuff on the radio, as I say. I was sad when Roy Hudd died recently because Friday night was the Roy Hudd Lines programme. I used to love listening to that. But commentary was what I wanted to do. My dad did it for the Rex Blind parties. I did it at the Rex Blind parties and I fancied doing it on the radio. The big commentators back then on Radio Scotland were David Francy, retired late 80s, Derek Ray, who took over from him, who now works in America for ESPN mm-hmm. and others. And I think the guy who was my hero was Richard Park. And Richard Park was the architect of football radio in the modern age. He's the guy, the first presenter of the Super Scoreboard program at Radio Clyde. Mm-hmm. He's the guy that goes to America and comes back and says, I've heard this thing, it's called the phone-in, and starts that. He's the guy that introduces live commentary to Radio Clyde, presents it, commentates on it, with this, you know, by all accounts, could hardly see the length of himself. And his player identification was weak, to say the least. But he had a joie de vivre about him. And he's now a very wealthy man. And he's in his 70s now and still runs what was the Capital Radio Group. Mm-hmm. Global as it is now. So the guy is the most gifted guy that probably radio has produced. A great ear for picking hits as well. Yeah. And at Clyde, he did the lunchtime show. So I heard him at lunchtime, which had the football sports desk with the late, great Jimmy Sanderson, who was the original shock jock pundit. Although when you listen back to old tapes, not that shocking. And when Jimmy died in 1986, Hugh Keevans, a young man called Hugh Keevans, took over. Mm-hmm. And Hugh, of course, I spoke to him yesterday, actually. Hugh is still doing it. So, mm-hmm. So Richard was amazing. He did a nighttime phone-in called Dr. Dick's Midnight Surgery, which I think Ofcom would shut down now because it was risque, to say the least. So he was my hero, and I wanted to be that. And there is a tape somewhere of me, about 8 years old, reading out the Daily Record sports desk and reading out the back page of Daily Record, saying, you know, this is the sports desk with David Tanner, and here we are. So that was a long-held ambition. And I didn't actually broadcast that much on radio. I remember doing hosting a program 25 years ago this week called Super Cooper, the night that Davy Cooper died. Mm. And, you know, did some sports desks. But, I mean, I was the producer of the program for many years. And so I was happy with the behind-the-scenes role. And I got a call one day from STV saying, would you like to come and work on Scott Sport and Extra Time? They were two big brands at the time. Mm-hmm. And off I went. And I'd never considered TV until then. Not once.
That's interesting. And many a young boy or girl, including myself, would be very envious of the fact that you get so close to the heroes and you get so close to the action as well. But how was it you got your big break on television, David?
Well, as I say, in 1995, I got the call from STV, and it was Jerry McNee, who's the governor. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. The best football journalist, commentator, summariser, analyst has been. Mm-hmm. And may I say, for me, a wonderful human being as well. He texted me recently, and you know, I still get excited when you get a message from Jerry. Very unpopular with the punters because he knew how just to wind them all up. A terrific operator, and you know, when he'd signed off me going there, it was great. So I went in there as a reporter, not a clue what I was doing. I mean, there was no training for STV, you just get thrown into it. It took me long enough to work out what was going on with the technical side of it. And then I was told, we want you to front the news. Jim Delahunt was the main presenter on Scotland Today, as it was called back then. It's now called STV News at 6. Mm-hmm. Shireen Nanjiani, John Mackay was just starting then. Viv Lumsden were the main presenters. Angus Simpson was another one. So I did that. But I mean, I was terrified. That was January 96. I was 23. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely terrified because I hadn't prepared well enough for that, looking back on it. But I mean, the exposure that got you, because that was unbelievable. And it was life-changing because overnight there were suddenly people talking to you whom you didn't know. And that was quite a difficult concept to get used to. So that was how they put me on a bit earlier. I think Jim Delahunt wasn't well and they couldn't find Jim White. So they said, right, it's you. When you look at the staff that BBC Scotland have got, for example, they've got hundreds of staff in sport now. I mean, we had it was Jim Delahunt, myself, Jim White, Jerry McNee. Oh, my colleague, the late Fraser Robertson, was there for a bit. But that was it. So it was absolutely terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. I'm 23. You should be nowhere near the evening news at that age. But there I was. And a suit that didn't fit me. I had a great time. I remember walking down our girls' street run about there with my mother. And I saw a woman nudging the man that she was walking with, her husband or whatever, and pointing at me. And I thought, oh God, here we go. Because I wasn't quite used to handling. I didn't always know what to say to people when they came up, because they often say stupid things. And that woman said, there's that wee beep. Off the telly. And she said it at full volume. She dropped the big one, shall we say, right? She said it at full volume. And I could feel my mother going, wobbling. And I thought, God, why would you say that? You know, and she kind of waved and smiled. And I kind of waved and gave her a kind of grimace back. It was sometimes bad language in Glasgow is used as a term of warmth, a term of endearment. So it was quite a lot to get used to early on. And I remember somebody yelling at me at Brockville Park. And I turned around and waved, thinking it was a mate of mine, because I wasn't used to folk shouting, "Hey, Tanner," if they didn't know me. But now people knew who I was without me knowing them. So it took a lot to get used to. It was quite funny.
And as I also mentioned at the start, you were involved in a wonderful event in Scottish football, Sir Rod Stewart's incredible Scottish Cup appearance, which livened the draw. Unlike anything that Scottish football has ever seen before. Now, for us as viewers, it was fantastic television, but do you admit to feeling a wee bit anxious about Sir Rod going off-piste to the extent that he did? Most importantly, how did you keep your composure during the broadcast?
To be perfectly honest with you, I didn't realise quite how wacky it was because I wasn't watching it. Because during the Scottish Cup draw is a terrifying thing to do because you get a very short space of time and you've got to write all the draws down and look at your stats and think, well, what's the story in that one? What's the tie of the round? Where's the connections between that team and that team? And was that a famous final? And was that, what's the Scottish Cup history of that matchup? You know, that sort of thing. You know, is that the bottom team in the league playing the top team in the league? You know, all these sort of things. So I was jotting it down. And before it, to put some context in it, I looked at my phone and I was looking at Twitter on my phone. We were at Airdrie Onions Football Club that day, where Albion Rovers were playing Celtic. And we did two games. We did a game in the morning and then the Celtic game was on in the afternoon and the draw was after it. And I saw on Twitter a picture of Rod arriving at Airdrie, and he's wearing a fur coat like John Motson on the very stylish, a big tiger skin scarf, and he was doing a kind of starfish. He was kind of jumping up in the air, you know, with his hands up and his legs up, and his eyes looked a bit bloodshot, and I thought, oh right, okay, a bit of good lunch, Rod. Thought no more of it. Anyway, it came time to go to the draw after Celtic had beaten Albion Rovers, and I was told by the producer, right, link to commercial break and tease the fact that we've got the draw coming up. So and we'll give you live pictures of them all standing there. So I said, right, coming up after the break, it's the draw for the fourth round of the William Hill Scottish Cup. There they are, they're all in position. Alan Stubbs, Alan McRae, and Rod Stewart. And Rod said, "Sir Rod Stewart." Of course, yes, Sir Rod. Congratulations on knighthood. Back in a minute. He'd just been knighted in the year's honours list. And during the commercial break, I spoke off air to them because I was in the studio at the other side of the ground. And I could tell they were having a bit of a laugh. But that's good. You want that because, you know, when the nerves... It's got a nervy thing, the cup draw, because if it goes wrong, and I've been there when it's gone wrong... Christ. It's quite good. So anyway, Rod started with his foot. It was a wee bit like Len from Strictly Come Dancing. Seven. Oh yes, Celtic, yes. Oh, you know, and so after a while I picked up, but I missed most of it because I had my head on my iPad and my notepad or whatever. But at the end of it, I knew that they were having a laugh because I saw Rod giving the bottom of the president of the SFA at the time, Alan McRae, a little tweak. So I knew there was a bit of hilarity. And Alan, of course, is just doing what he always does, you know, right back to you, David. And Rod said, "David, where's David? Where is he? So he's larking about there. And I think I said something along the lines of, "Rod, I said, "Rod, that was terrific. If your voice ever goes, there's a great career ahead of you and as a bingo caller," which gave him a hoot. I'll tell you a funny thing. The next day, I was shopping in Edinburgh Waitrose in Morningside, and a woman came up to me, mm-hmm. a woman in her probably in her 50s, kind of Blue Rins Morningside set, and she said to me, you're that man off television, aren't you? Because this, and I thought, oh God, here we go, because this video had gone everywhere, and I still see it on clip shows on the telly, but it'd gone everywhere. And I get calls, text messages from Craig Moore, an old Rangers captain in Australia, my brother-in-law in Hong Kong, Mo Johnston, ex-Celtic Rangers in America, texted me, teasing me about it. So it had gone completely viral around the world, and it was in the press in China, because where my brother-in-law saw it. And so this lady came up and saying hello to me. I thought, oh, not a usual football punter, but that was nice. And she said, look, can I get your autograph? And I signed it. She said, can I get a wee selfie of you and me for my my daughter? I said, yeah, of course. But delighted. Standing in my gym kit, you know, sweating. And she said, that's great. Thanks very much. She said, but listen, before you go, I must ask you a question. Now, whenever anyone says that to a sports broadcaster, what it's usually followed by, what team do you support? But she said, so I must ask you a question. What's the weather going to be like tonight, Sean? So I thought, do I tell her that I'm not Sean Batty, the STV weatherman? Or do I just smile sweetly and say it's going to rain? Mm-hmm. So I said it's going to rain, and I was probably right. There you go. So, yeah, that was a good, it was great. But Rod Stewart, what a star. Very, very lucky to have had a few interviews with him over the years, and great value. Because, I mean, he's a proper world superstar. Yeah. You know, very friendly with Gordon Strachan. Very, very friendly with Gordon Strachan. And he told me once that he got into Celtic because his dad was from Leith. Although they all moved to London. Hence his accent, and but he said the reason he was into Celtic because he used to hang about Rangers. There's pictures of him at Rangers and Celtic. He really got into Celtic when he met Jimmy Johnston and Dixie Deans, two players of the 70s, and their force of personality hooked him into that group and therefore into Celtic. So there you go.
I actually turned 21 a couple of days after the cup draw, and that's always something that I remember about my 21st birthday was Rod Stewart, because me, my dad, my cousin, my uncle were watching it that day, and again, I think everybody was all the same opinion, really. Just it was just one of the most memorable moments, certainly, in my 24 years on this planet.
I'm glad to have played a small part in that, Claire. A good old-fashioned Scottish football shambles.
Definitely. And on a serious note, I mean, we were talking about your grandparents earlier on, and I'm interested to find out about a wee bit about their eye conditions and things. Were they born blind, or did their eye conditions deteriorate as they got older?
My grandfather was blind from birth, and apparently it was due to neglect at birth. And he did have a bit of a blink, as he called it. He could see kind of colours, the outline of colours. So the tram cars in those days didn't have numbers, they had colours, the different routes, red trams and blue trams and all the rest of it. So he was able to make that out, but his eyes did hurt him. He got quite a lot of pain from his eyes, and eventually he had them removed and had glass eyes. He's one of his party pieces was his joke about rolling his eyes across the room, which he could do literally. He could literally roll his eyes. So Granddad was sort of blind, and Granny could see up until she was in her 30s, for whatever it was, it could have been glaucoma. Can't remember now, but she was completely blind. By 40. So you think back to it, you know, my father was born during the war, just after the Blitz, the Clydeside Blitz, you know. I came across an amazing photograph recently of Springburn where dad was born and raised. And it was all the railway works. They lived right next to the Cali railway works. And all the writing on the map is in German. Because it's a Luftwaffe reconnaissance picture, you know, and they were a target. And, you know, when you think back to it, you know, a blind couple flying at the back, you know, going down the stairs out to the Anderson shelter, it must have been terrifying. But, yeah, so they were blind for a granda from birth and granny from 30s, 40s. So, and they lived till they were both in their late 70s when they died. So they were the big figures in the Glasgow blind community. My grandfather worked at Blindcraft all his days. Initially, it was in the Royal Infirmary building. And which was in the trolley bus route, which was the trolley buses were known as the Silent Death. But my grandfather, they had a couple of accidents in there, he said, because of Castle Street trolley bus services. And if you, whenever I go past the Royal Infirmary now, there is a statue there, sandstone statue, if you look up, of Christ with his hand and a little blind boy. From its days, that part of the Royal Infirmary building being the Blindcraft. It moved out to Saracen in Apostle Park. And then in the 80s, it moved to where it is now in Springburn. In fact, we were there when the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh opened it. Granddad was long retired, but David McCarroll, who I think retired recently as well, actually, who ran the Blindcraft, invited us along to that. So they were a big part of the blind community.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And how did you and your family cope with having family members that were so close to you who were completely blind?
Well, there wasn't any question of coping. It's just the way it was. I mean, we never thought it was being unusual. Never thought of it as being unusual. You knew that sauce bottles were left on their side and I've always tried to practice walking in the dark since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So there's a power cut, I always know where I'm going, and I knew mm-hmm. I copied how my grandfather and my granny walked about, and it was just part of life. You learn how to guide them, you know. It's amazing the amount of blind people you see being kind of pushed around. And I've shown people, no, let them take your arms so you do it. I've met people in the family who get visual impairments who can't do that. So it was a big part of life. And it was just, you thought nothing of it. I would read the newspaper to my granny when I went up, we were there every Saturday, at least once a week, every Saturday. My grandfather would sit in the corner and read the paper in Braille. It was Perth Prison that used to do it back then. I'm not sure about now, but you got the Racing Post in Braille and I think the Daily Record. So he would sit and granny didn't read Braille, so I used to have to read the horoscopes. So to granny used to have a bit of fun and make them up a wee bit, I have to admit. Make them more interesting. So, yeah, it's just part of life. We thought nothing of it. I think nothing of it now when looking back on it.
And the Scottish sports journalist Rex Kingsley thought of the idea to commentate for blind and partially sighted people after witnessing a man commentating to his two blind friends in 1937. Now, your grandfather was a fundamental part in the foundation of the Rex Blind Party. Can you tell us a story about how he got involved with the organisation?
Yeah. Rex was the chief football writer at the Sunday Mail and did entertainment as well. I've got his autobiography up the stairs, which he wrote before the war. And it's got pictures of him with Laurel and Hardy and other big names from Hollywood when he went over there. It's called I Saw Stars, his book. I found a copy online recently, and it was bought by John Kennedy, the Celtic assistant manager, because there's a big chapter on his grandfather, Jimmy Delaney, and his transfer from Celtic to Manchester United. And that's his maternal grandfather, Jimmy Delaney. So I put Big John in touch with that because his mother collects stuff on her father. It's a terrific book. Very interesting reading about the, you know, the behaviour of football people at the time. And Rex decided at Christmas time that he would do a good deed for Christmas time. And one of the things that he'd seen at a game when he was there as a journalist, and he was also a BBC radio commentator, he famously did a commentary of a game, I think it was at Tynecastle, during the Blitz. And he couldn't see the pitch, but was told that he had to do the commentary and not mention the fog because it might entice the Germans to come over, or it might tell the Germans not to come over because of fog. Seems unlikely they'd be listening to a football commentary, but you never know. So it's a really famous wartime story, that. But anyway, he'd seen these guys, some fella commentating to some blind punters, and he said, wouldn't it be good to organise this? And I could do the commentary for them. And he got in touch with whatever Blindcraft was called back then, the Blind Asylum or whatever it was back then. And they got half a dozen or so fellas to go along on Christmas Day 37. The game he picked was in the top Scottish league at the time, between 3rd Lanark, who went defunct in 67, and Hearts. And it was on Christmas Day. So he took the blind fellas out for lunch, treated them to a nice Christmas lunch, and then did the commentary for them with a free ticket. So that's where it started. And the name Rex comes from his pen name. Back then, you know, if you were writing in the newspaper, you had a pen name. So it wouldn't have been David Tanner. It might have been, I don't know, Dat or something like that, because his name was Robert Kingsley, R-E-K, Rec. So they called it Rex. So that's where it came from. And, you know, that it still bears his name today. And it's quite a legacy, isn't it? Quite a legacy. You think of all the fans, all the commentaries, all the games over the years. It's terrific. So I was very pleased to be a part of that.
Absolutely. And what a beautiful story it is. And hence the reason why it still exists today.
It's the Christmas gift that keeps on giving, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, without a doubt. And your father, David Senior, who is an MBE, may I add, he was a commentator for many, many years with the Rex Blind Party during the week. He was an officer for HM Customs and Excise.
He was.
And at the weekend and some days during the week, he volunteered as a commentator for the Rex Blind Parties. And after many years of delivering the commentaries and putting in so much time and effort, he was given the role of honorary president of the organisation. Did your dad grasp the idea of commentating for blind and partially sighted people because of your grandfather?
Yeah, he did. He did. He did his first commentary at the age of 8, sat on my grandfather's shoulders, and there may have been a shortage of commentators, and that's how he got his first break at it. So, I mean, he was, in many ways, the guiding light of the organisation for 40, 50 years. He was the secretary and, as I say, the driving force. Looking back on it, he probably put in too much time at it. Such was his commitment. But, you know, he turned it. It's a very slick organisation now. With, you know, we used to all huddle in corners on the terracing and scream and shout, and now everyone's seated and safely, and there's all the electrical kit, and there's membership badges and ID badges and numbers and whatnot. Before that, it was a bit, it was less formal, less organised, and it was unfit for purpose for the modern age. So he helped modernise it as well. So he did a lot of work. He did a lot of work, you know, and he brought, they organised all these functions that he used to have, and probably still do. So he put in a tremendous amount of work because it was so close to his heart. and still is. I mean, he doesn't get out much now, Dad. But he certainly was very proud of his association and very proud to take such a leading role in it, you know. And you know, obviously, I'm proud of him for doing that as well.
So you should be. And the man who actually followed up your dad as the new honorary president, Billy Owen, also worked as an officer for customs and excise during the week and volunteered at the weekends too. Did Billy's involvement with the organisation stem through working with your dad?
Yeah, I believe it did. And also there was John Cochrane, who died recently, who was another customs officer. Brother-in-law of David Moyes, who did the commentary at Thistle for many years as well. So there was a handful of customs and excise officers doing commentaries and doing a bit around there. So I suppose it was their way of giving something back to a community that they taxed so heavily, Claire. They were just giving us something back, and good on them for doing that.
And I'm honestly so proud to be the daughter of a customs officer and the organisation, in the sense that there's so many people who dedicated their time to helping blind and partially sighted people. It really fills me with pride. I know from doing my research that you're interested in other sports in addition to football, like boxing and golf. And besides football, is there any other sports that you think would be suitable for blind and partially sighted people to receive commentary for?
Well, I think any sport is suitable for commentary for blind people. You can commentate on anything at all. Now, you have to ask yourself, why is it that blind and visually impaired people go to a football game? Well, they don't go to see the football unless they've got some vision. So why are they going? They're going for, as I understand it, the community, the thrill, the smell of the pies or the liniment or whatever it is that excites, for the social element, for a couple of beers, for many beers. I'm not saying that about you, Claire. For the walk, for the fresh air, whatever it is that gets you to the football game, that experience can be replicated at any sport, in my view. It's really a case of supply and demand. If there is a demand for it, then hopefully the sport can supply the access, and hopefully the community can supply a commentator.
That's fantastic. And I've been a member of my blind party for 3 seasons now at the club that I support. And apart from myself and one of my best friends, Eilish, most of the people in the blind party, I would say, were middle-aged or elderly men and women.
So that's a good thing, being middle-aged, Claire.
So how do we get out to not to 30-year-olds to join the blind party?
Well, it's not from middle-aged people like me. It's from people like you, Claire, because you're the person that goes along. I'm going to turn this interview on you. Why do you go along to the football with the Rex Blind Party?
Well, I go along because when I lost my sight 6 years ago, do you know, it was one of the most devastating things ever. And one of the hardest things for me was not being able to see the football again, clearly, because I've been a football fan. I started really getting into football at age 7. And since then, I've become more and more fanatical about it. And it was one of the things that really, really crushed me. It really crushed my spirit, just not being able to see the players, being able to see the colours. Colours is a massive thing for me. And that was one of the things that really, really broke my heart when I lost my sight. So getting back, I needed to get back and just enjoy it again. And to be honest, when I went back after I lost my sight, I went back to the football We were playing Legia Warsaw in the Champions League qualifier back in 2014. Celtic were playing Legia Warsaw, and that was my first game back. And I remember going with my uncle, and it just wasn't the same. And then it was two seasons after, when Jim spotted me, Jim Lewis, at Celtic Park. Again, my uncle was with me then, and he says to me to join the blind party. And I was, as I mentioned earlier on, quite stubborn by nature. I was like that. I thought to myself, you know, I need to check my mom and my dad first. But then I thought to myself, this is going to help me. And you know what? I've not looked back. It has been the most amazing thing ever. I mean, Jim and Ronnie, I cannot speak highly for the two men. It's just incredible. The fact that they are giving up their time, and like your dad, like Billy Owen, like all these guys, they give up their time. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing, really. Just giving up your time and helping people who are less fortunate. And I'm not discriminating against myself, but it is true. You're helping someone who has not got the luxury of having full vision like you guys do. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I mean, you know, hats off to anybody who does that. And I've just loved it. I've just loved going into my own wee world and enjoying it, and you know, just being with everybody, being with people of different age groups and things, and it's just wonderful. And it's really, really, you know, it's changed me, and I'm more insightful about football. Before, I used to go to the games. And I would always tape the highlights afterwards, because there was stuff that I was missing. My dad was trying his best, like the blind man in the original Rex Blind Party story. He was trying his best to describe it to me. But the fact that I'm in the party, I don't need to look on the pitch, because they're giving me what's on the pitch. But I do look as well, because there's stuff that I can make out, and it's just a beautiful thing. It's beautiful that, you know, people of all ages are coming together, and, you know, we've all got that common bond, but ultimately we're all different in our own way as well. And I would highly recommend it to so many people who are struggling with, you know, not being able to go to the football, and you know, people who say are getting into football and things. I would really, really recommend that you join it.
Well, there you go then. So there is the advert for the Rex Blind Parties and for getting into the football. One last question for you on this. I don't remember Greenock Morton playing against Legia Warsaw. It's my memory playing up on me.
Yeah.
But that's great to hear that about Jim Lewis, Ronnie Reagan, no relation to the president, by the way. I remember asking Ronnie, were you named after the president? And he said, no, he said, I was named after Ronnie Simpson. So there you go. And before them, Willie Henderson, who retired recently, did it for 50 years at Celtic Park. You know, they will appreciate hearing how much their efforts mean to you as well. So that's what it's all about. I mean, that question you've answered there, I've been answering that since I was a kid, when people said, oh, why do blind people go to football games? And as I say, I saw the camaraderie and the lifelong friendships that grew out of going to the football, just as it would for the able-bodied people, and the thrill of being there and the atmosphere and the great kick that we get on big occasions. So that's really, really nice to hear. Good. Well, I'm glad about that. And I hope others will follow your lead and get along to the game. Because, yeah, we do want younger fans to come through. But we want fans of all ages. But most of all, we want fans who enjoy it as much as you did. And when you were telling that story, you were smiling. I'm watching you on Skype here in our glorious self-isolation, and your smile lit up the screen. So good on you for
that. Thank you so much. Thank you. And I would like to know from you, is there any advice that you would give to anybody from your perspective? I've obviously given my perspective about the Blind Party, but is there anything you would say to young people who are, you know, teetering over whether to join a Blind Party or whatever? And is there anything that you would say to them to try and get them to go along to a Blind Party?
Teeter in the direction of the Blind Party, try it, just give it a try, and you won't regret it. You won't regret it. As I say to you, there are men that, and it was just men who went to the football by and large when my grandfather was going, but they were at his funeral, you know, and I still see them at games sometimes at Celtic Park in Ibrox where they're behind the dugout. And it's like lifelong friendships come of it. There was a female commentator, Hazel Orr, who sadly died a few years ago prematurely. Her mum died last year. And Hazel's father, Lochie Orr, was the secretary of the RICS for a long time. Mm-hmm. And Hazel was a female commentator in the 70s. So long before this kind of push to get female sports presenters and commentators, we had a female, and they were profiled on nationwide on the BBC, which was the national 6 o'clock news on the BBC, and there was a big profile on their ex-Blind Parties, and Hazel featured prominently in that. So it was we've got more females than ever before, and that'll continue to grow. And so you are an advert for that, Claire. So it's been nice to hear your story. And I'm sure it's been the same for everyone listening at home.
And is there any words of advice that you would give to any budding commentators who would like to give it a go because they've got an aptitude for it?
Well, it's a great opportunity to learn how to cut your teeth in commentary by going along to the Blind Parties. You know, I did it as a kid, and I've not done a lot of commentary in my TV career or my radio career, funnily enough. But it was what I wanted to do. Alistair Alexander, who was the main commentator on Radio Scotland Sports Sound for many years, and Sports Scene for many years, there's a lot of... he did the late 70s, a lot of the commentary games, a lot of Kenny Dalglish goals on YouTube that Alistair was a commentator on. He retired about 4 or 5 years ago. Alistair was a St Mirren commentator for ex-Blind Parties. So it is a way, you know, to practice your skills and to get involved if you were to want to cut your teeth and move on in a commentary career, you know. But I mean, first and foremost, it's about making somebody's day. I never did it because I wanted to work in radio. It was coincidental. It wasn't a coincidence. It was because of doing it for the ex I wanted to do radio. So I mean, first and foremost, you wanted to help people see the game that otherwise couldn't, and you know, and you had the responsibility of guiding them back to the supporters bus or wherever they were going, and buying them drink. I seem to remember that quite a lot.
Yeah,
you look like a pint drinker to me.
No, certainly not. I'm only a cider person, but
that's worse.
But that's another story, really. But anyway, I mean, I really, really hope that we can get the word out there to young people who are wanting to join, commentators, and just in general, just people raising awareness of this wonderful, wonderful charity that I just, it's changed my life. It really has. And it's really, really made me, you know, it's changed my perspective in watching football. I've just really, really loved it. And I hope that everybody listening at home has really, you know, took the message of the ex-Blind Party on board and has learned something new about it. And more importantly, has learned about your story as well. It's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And as I said, I mean, we've obviously got the connections there as well. So, you know, it's fantastic. David Tanner, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today, and thank you very much.
Claire Ford, it's been a pleasure to be on it and be interviewed by you as well, which I think you've done really well. So thank you very much for that. It's been charming to chat to you and also hear your enthusiasm for life and for going to the football with Rex. So that's great.
Thank you.
And keep on supporting Morton.